when you all go to sleep.
The Dalai Lama said that if you can't help, at least don't be a troublemaker. At the very least, don't be a troublemaker. The talk tonight about being a good person. Firstly, we have to work out what are the advantages of being a good person, because we're all looking for our own advantages. It's natural. In fact, all beings want happiness and never want suffering. It's the basic drive that all beings want. For a dog, it may be a bone. For us, it may be passing exams, a car, whatever. But we want happiness. That's our driving force. Unfortunately, what we look for in happiness is impermanent. Things we choose to make us happy are impermanent. So, by the nature of their impermanence, we then get disappointed. Our cars rust out. Our exams are forgotten in the view of another exam coming up. And so we move on. So in a sense, Buddhism is about finding out what creates happiness and finding out what doesn't create happiness. Finding out what creates a bad effect, finding out what creates a good effect. And when we work that out, they're all the tools we need for our life. And Buddhism's often been said it's a religion, but it's also been said as a way of life. And there's often a debate for non-Buddhists who say, oh, is it a religion or is it a way of life? The answer to that is yes. It's both. It's a way of looking at life, and it's a way of functioning within society that brings about harmony for not just ourselves but others. You can't isolate yourself and say, oh, well, I'm going to have happiness and the other person I don't care about. It doesn't work that way. We are in society. We're in communion with everybody. If you think about your lives and think about how many people that you interact with each day, I'm not talking about your friends, I'm talking about the person in the shop, the person driving next to you, the person you pass in the street. We are constantly in that interaction. And there's a wonderful quote here. I've got some quotes here tonight. I don't often have quotes, but I've got some great quotes here tonight. From Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful Thich Nhat Hanh, Theravadan monk. And he says, if in our daily life we can smile, if we can be peaceful and happy, not only we, but everyone will profit from it. This is really simple stuff. This is the most basic kind of peace work. Just creating a little bit of harmony for those people that we pass by. I saw a wonderful, this is going back many years, probably, I'd have to say it's going back about 15 or 16 years, and I was at Central Station on the country platform waiting for somebody. And I was just sitting observing, watching human beings doing their travelling and moving around. And along walked this woman who was absolutely almost bent in half. She was like that, and she couldn't lift her head up. So she was really almost a right angle, the poor woman walking along the station. And it looked, you know, really a difficult life. And this guy, she didn't look like she was struggling, but she wasn't doing it easily, I can say that for sure. And I'm just watching this, and it was a little bit of a distance, and this guy comes up to her and says, can I, and he actually had to bend down like this to talk to her because her head was really, really misshapen in the whole body. He said, can I help you? And I saw the most wonderful thing. She turned with the most beautiful smile, seriously beautiful smile, and she said, no, thank you, dear, I'm absolutely fine. But He was actually got the gift. There he was trying to help. And the way she gave this smile and this attitude towards him was really, it just lit up the station. And I thought, in this simple act of kindness from him, created this absolutely wonderful situation between two people. Now, that to me is Dharma practice. It's not sitting, meditating for 15 hours and achieving great states of mind and being illustrious, although Buddhists can do that. But it's this simple act of kindness and this interchange. And there she was, obviously not having an easy life, but the generosity of her smiling back to this guy really took him back. And he went, oh, okay. She was really absolutely okay. Emotionally, she was okay. Mentally, she was okay. Her body was misshapen. And she appreciated this guy coming up to her. But that was being a good person. We might chuck that door closed, actually. Otherwise, I might start singing. So, this is about being a good person. Buddhism is about being a good person. The whole of it is about being a good person. And firstly, we have to work out what we need to know about that. So, what's the technology of being a good person? And it's understanding the law of karma. Now, what is the law of karma? I'm asking a question here, everybody. In case you missed it, don't jump at me all at once. What is the law of karma? Oh, come on. Don't be shy, please. I can wait all night.
Action and reaction.
Beautiful. Nicely put. Very simple. It's cause and effect. Action and reaction. And there are laws of karma that govern this. A positive cause will result in a positive reaction. Bingo. A negative cause will result in a negative result. So here we have very, very clear cause and effect. If you do a negative action, you will receive a negative result. If you do a positive action, you will receive a positive result. So how do we work out what a positive cause is and what a negative cause is? I'm really paring this down right to the basics here. We're not talking about the nature of reality at the moment. We're just talking about really basic stuff. How do I work out what is a positive result, what's a negative result, or cause that creates those? Do I write a list? I write a big list, or do I go by some guidelines? And beautifully, there is a set of guidelines that the Buddha set down. Do you know what they're called? Precepts, yeah. Well, yeah, in a sense, precepts. Actually, glad you brought that up. When the Buddha was around, he at first didn't make precepts or rules. He didn't make them up. He didn't say, okay, well, here's your list, guys, go away and do that. But what happened, he implemented them as things happened. Buddha, I just stole this chicken. Okay, no stealing. You can't steal a chicken. And as people started doing things, he goes, no, you can't do that. And he started writing the laws because of the human nature. People didn't actually know. They weren't that clear. I mean, we do have an innate sense of right and wrong, but it went down in the Tibetan system. For a monk, there's 256 vows. We lay people like myself really don't know many of them, but I know one of them, which would seem unusual, is when a monk's walking, he can't swing his arms like that. Why would that be?
Because it might hurt someone.
Pardon?
It might hurt someone.
Yeah, it might hurt somebody. might hurt something. So just, and what you find is all the vows of a monk and a nun are actually to do with mindfulness, being aware right now. And someone was asking me that the other day, well, what about this being aware right now? Well, where's yesterday? Where's 10 minutes ago? Could someone show me 10 minutes ago? No. Okay. Could someone show me 10 minutes in the future? Not possible. Okay, 5 minutes ago. 2 minutes? 1 minute? Ah, it's gone. And so we actually only have the present. I'm going to find another quote here because I found one earlier. Where is it? Where was it? Oh, maybe I didn't put it in. Oh, here it is, by the Buddha himself. The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, nor to worry about the future, but to live the present moment wisely and earnestly. What a wonderful quote. We spend, and interestingly enough, some of the courses that I've taught over the years, things on stress management that I give to companies. Stress, if you want to know what stress is, it's past regret and guilt and future worry. That's stress. And that's what people do all the time. And then someone says to me, a business person will say, well, what about planning? What about planning the budget? Or, well, that's a present time activity. It's not a worry. And you really, this is really important for our lives. You need to know what is planning and what is worry. You have to work it out. Because if you don't, you are going to spend your life causing yourself grief. But not only that, and this is why I'm talking about the broader community, while you are worrying, you're not helping. You are hindering. You may become agitated. You may become angry, fearful, and those around you won't be having a good time. You won't be smiling at them while you're worried about the future. And this is the process of looking at your lives. And so going back to karma, working out what creates these positive effects. And really, it's very, very simple. It's not, sure, we have a list. We have the Eightfold Path, which I'm going to read out in a minute. That's a way of looking at our lives. It's been spelled out. But if you really just analyse it on a personal level, what am I doing right now that's creating a positive result? Am I being difficult? Am I being grasping? Am I being miserly? Every action that's about getting more for myself is creating a negative result. Every ounce of grasping, I want more, I want this. Has anyone ever grasped at food? Has anyone ever grasped at too much food? What's the result? It's pain and suffering. I wish I hadn't have eaten that. We can see it all the time, this attitude of wanting more, more, more. The economic students call it the diminishing returns, don't they? Get the diminishing returns. Even economics talks about the suffering of diminishing returns. And so Buddhism is about becoming aware of our lives and where we're at. It's not about wishing, oh, I hope one day, then I'll be happy. If only, then I'll be happy. If only this person was in my life, then I'll be happy forever. If only this person was out of my life, then I'll be happy. If only I had that, then I'll be happy. If only I had this creation of grasping that we constantly do just brings us more suffering. and it's creating negative results. So if we start to work that out and say, okay, well, what? There's, interestingly enough, I heard this many years ago, there was a Buddhist therapist, psychotherapist in Los Angeles. And this psychotherapist had one question. Just one question to the person that was coming to them. What is your motivation? Oh, I'm having this. What is your motivation? What is motivating you? What do you want? Oh, I want to be happy and I'm depressed. What are you doing? What's your motivation behind it? If you start to use that as a template for what you're doing, then firstly you may be embarrassed, which is probably a good thing. And secondly, you may stop some actions that you think are bringing a positive result because you go, oh, okay, that's really selfish of me. But we also have to be aware, and this is getting a little bit into more detail, we have to be aware of what is selfish and what is idiot compassion. And we do have this problem of idiot compassion. It's where we have decided that we are good people and we are going to, whenever we see a little old lady on the side of the road ready to cross, we are going to take her across the road because that's what we do. And I remember telling this story once to Unibuds, and I said, yeah, and you've got the little old lady halfway across the road and she's saying, I don't want to go. And this person said, yeah, that happened to me. I just decided I was going to take someone across the road because that's what I do, because I'm a good person. And she started hitting me with her umbrella and said, I'm not going across the road, you fool. And this, again, has to be our awareness. So you can't just say, okay, that's a good thing to do, I'm going to do that in every situation, because life isn't like that. We have grey areas in our lives. So we have to use our awareness. We have to develop our wisdom to know when is the right time to be compassionate and the other time to leave things alone. Many years ago, I was at a Buddhist monastery in Queensland called Chen Raising Institute. And there was a woman there I knew who was actually quite crazy. They let her stay there, but she was really, she was actually schizophrenic. And she used to do some things that used to really freak people out. When people were meditating, she would, the temple was a wooden structure, and she would stomp around the outside of the temple while everyone was meditating, and no one would say anything. You don't want to upset her. No. We're trying to be good Buddhists here. We don't want to upset her. Instead of someone going out and saying, "Look, would you be quiet and stop doing that?" they all kind of backed off because, oh no, you can't. In the early days of Buddhism, there was very, particularly for Western students, there was very little known. So it was sort of about, Buddhism was about, oh, look, you don't upset anyone and you don't, you know, you're not clear about things. And it was very muddy, very wishy-washy. The lamas used to call it hippie mentality, you know. Or what do they used to, call it tissue paper mind. Whichever way the wind blowed seemed to be okay. Anyway, this woman, I was doing a course up. This is going back before most of you were born. Was any 1978? Yeah, right. Got it, yeah. Okay. And I was very young. I was about 5 years of age. No, I wasn't. Anyway, I was in the. We just, a whole bunch of us had just arrived by train, and I'd heard about this woman Michelle. And they said, look, she's dark-haired and she's crazy, and just be a bit careful because she really is nuts. And we're all in this kitchen. We're all wanting to be good Buddhists. And Michelle walks into the kitchen and says, who's a good Buddhist here? And this one guy goes, she went, oh, I need a hand. And the kitchen was at the bottom of the hill, and there was this hill like this up to the temple. And she gave this guy a box, and we watched him walk up the hill with a box, and then walk down the hill with a box, and then walk up the hill with a box, and walk down the hill with the ball. And he just kept doing it. And we're going, oh, my goodness. He could have said to her, I'm sorry, I've done this three times. You haven't put anything in the box. You're just walking me back up and down the hill. But because he was a good Buddhist, he was showing idiot compassion. And I think he did it for about an hour. You know. This is about being mindful. So we don't just go out of our way to be compassionate in all situations. The funny thing that goes on with that is that I could see this happening. And I went, oh, I'm going to stay out of her way. We did the two-week course, and then at the end of the two-week course, Michelle walks up to me and she said, why have you been avoiding me? Oh, well, too hard. But so, and, you know, we saw some very funny things happen. But what you've got to realise that you have to, and this is really interesting. When we do a visualisation in the Tibetan system, we visualise a lotus under the Buddha. What does the lotus represent? Renunciation. And what are we renouncing? Chocolate. No? What are we renouncing? We're renouncing negative states of mind and the causes of negative states of mind. That's what we're renouncing. We're not actually renouncing chocolate. Although probably for some it would be a good idea. But renouncing negative states of mind is what the lotus represents. And then on top of that, we visualise in the Tibetan system a moon cushion. And the moon cushion represents ultimate compassion. Ultimate compassion. The desire, the wish, and the action to achieve full enlightenment to save all beings from suffering. There is no greater altruistic attitude than that. The desire to save all beings from suffering without exception. So you're not going to just save that person and that person because they're your friends, with every single person, every being out of suffering. So that's the moon cushion. And then sitting on top of that is the sun cushion, which represents wisdom, the ultimate wisdom and the relative wisdom. The ultimate wisdom is the way all phenomena exists. And does anyone know how all phenomena exist?
Well, it's a projection of mind.
Projection of mind, that's right. But how does that actual... Yeah, we project on it, absolutely. We impute, but exactly what is the definition of that wisdom, the ultimate wisdom? How does that exist? Come on.
I'm thinking of physics.
Pardon?
Physics.
Well, I will give you the answer. The answer is that it's empty of inherent existence and it's a dependent arising. There you go. Anyway. Look it up. We're not talking on emptiness tonight yet.
Can I just ask, what is a moon cushion and what is a sun cushion?
Oh, it's like a flat disc. They represent these things. It's like a moon and a sun, but they're flattened out, okay?
And they're shaped like a moon and a sun?
Yeah, they're round.
Oh, okay.
They're made of light.
Made of?
Light. They're a representation, okay? They're not. The moon actually isn't that thick.
No, sorry, so, I was thinking of a cushion.
No, yeah, well, it's sort of flat. So there's discs. So you've got the lotus, a disc, and a disc, and then sitting on top is the Buddha. And these are known as the three principal paths, which give rise to enlightenment. Firstly, renunciation, renouncing negative states of mind. So that means controlling the mind. Because a mind out of control does some positive things, but also does negative things and causes a whole lot of confusion. So this mind needs to be controlled to renounce the negativity. Then the moon cushion being the ultimate compassion, and then the sun cushion sitting on top. But if you have compassion without wisdom, you have what I was saying earlier, idiot compassion. If you have wisdom without compassion, you have an understanding, but you have no action. Compassion is an action. It's not just thinking, oh, I hope everyone's happy. It's not that. It's not, oh, I wish everyone was out of suffering. It's actually, and they have two kinds of compassion or bodhicitta. One is venturing. I'll put it easier this way. One is wishing bodhicitta, wishing that all beings are free from suffering. And the other one is what they call action or venturing, where you actually concretely do actions that bring about that state. And it's contemplation, meditation and all these things, but also quite actions. And this, I saw my teacher many times doing acts of compassion. And I'll tell you three of them. Two of them, one of them I was present at, two of them a friend told me, which were really interesting. I was coming out of some markets. Some of you know the stories. I've told it many times. But we were coming out of some markets in Melbourne, and this woman was getting out of a Mercedes-Benz and she was pulling these boxes out. And he literally ran. He was about 70 at the time. And he ran and he pulled all these boxes out of the car for her. Like, just spontaneously. I'm thinking, oh, look at the lama helping the lady out of the car with the boxes. And I'm saying, oh, wow. Gee, that's a good thing to do. Here am I thinking about it. And there's he's doing the actions. And he piles all the boxes neatly on the sidewalk and he walks off. And she turns... I'm standing there like, ugh. And she turns around to me and goes, oh, thank you. And I went, oh, that's okay. I didn't even do it. And he's gone... He didn't stay for the... I stayed for the thanks and I didn't do the job. And he's off down the road. And I went, wow. And that was a teaching. One of the wonderful things about being around a teacher is that you learn from their actions. Yes, the words are important, but their actions indelibly print themselves on your brain. So if you ever have the opportunity of being around a great teacher, watch what they do. It's often said in the Tibetan system that the attendant achieves enlightenment quicker than the students. The person that's washing the dishes and cleaning up or cooking for the teacher achieves more because they see this action all the time. This action of compassion and wisdom and clarity happening all the time. And they, by osmosis, they start to understand how to be. And so that was one of the things that he did. And the other one was, it was one Christmas, this is many years ago. My teacher passed away a couple of years ago, so he was 88. But this is many years ago, and it was Christmas Eve in Melbourne, and quite often he would go to India to the monasteries, but this one Christmas he was staying back, and this friend of mine went with him to a department store, and they were coming out of a department store. My friend said, as we stepped out, he said, we looked down the road, and down the road this brawl was going on outside a pub. There were people punching and fighting and kicking, and it was really a serious brawl. And he didn't hesitate. He said, oh, those silly people hurting themselves. And he walked straight towards them. Just didn't even hesitate. My friend went, oh, no. This is just, you know, what do we all do? We'd stay away from all that. He didn't even hesitate for a moment. He walked straight up to this group. And my friend said, I don't know what he did or what he said to them or how he did it. But the moment he got there, because he said, I stayed back. He didn't go with him. He said, I was scared. He said, they just all stopped and ran away. Now, I don't know how he did it or what he said or what he did. And my friend didn't hear. But they just all stopped and just took off. Stopped the fight immediately. That's an act of compassion. Incredible bravery. But just not even a hesitation. But you also have to know your own power to be able to do that. All right? So don't think that you can walk up to a brawl of 20 people and think you can stop it. That's dangerous. But he didn't hesitate. And so just looking at those acts of compassion. But he also did some clever things too. And this shows his wisdom. They were building a big temple down in Melbourne. And they'd hired a gardener to do the landscaping, and this guy was unbelievably lazy. He'd come some days and he'd say, oh, look, I'm coming tomorrow, and he wouldn't turn up, and, you know, it was really He wasn't a Buddhist or anything. He's just a hired landscaper. And this went on for quite a while. And finally, my teacher had heard about this guy not really doing his job and expecting to be paid. And so my friend was involved in this. And so he goes up to the gardener one afternoon and he says, "Come with me to my office." And there was a little, well, it was a generic, you know, everyone used this office in the centre. But on the way there, he grabbed three directors. He said, "You come with me and you come with me and you come with me." So the four of them all went over into the office. And one of my friends was part of one of the directors. And he said to the gardener, he said, "You stand there." And he turned round and he berated these three guys. "Look what's happened to the garden. It's a complete disaster." And he was really yelling at them. And this guy over here, and my friend, these three guys didn't have anything to do with the gardening. They hadn't organised it. They hadn't done anything with it. They weren't even part of the organisation. And they knew that. And he's berating them and telling them that they're completely lazy and useless. And, you know, why are they even in the centre if they're not sorting out the landscaping? And my friend said, he's standing there in the lounge, and he said, "This poor gardener's going white." Because he was the one that was doing the organising, but he wasn't being yelled at. And so, in the end, the Lama finished yelling at these three guys, and he turned round to the gardener, to the landscaper, and said, "Oh, you can go now." He turned up on time every time after that. And that's called skillful means and wisdom. Okay, he didn't berate the guy, he just showed the possibilities of getting into trouble. And anyway, the guy sorted it out and did his landscaping. So that's using wisdom. And in many ways, compassionate too. He didn't yell at this guy and really belittle him and, you know, tell him. He knew his students could cope with this. They'd often got verbal beatings for things, for being naughty or not being mindful. So this was, and they were fine. And they had such great devotion for their Lama, there wasn't a problem there at all. If he had said it to this guy, it could have caused this guy a lot of misery and unhappiness, and maybe would have resigned, who knows what the potential was. But he just did this wonderful, wonderful method. And he told me, actually, he actually became, in his earlier years, he was the disciplinary master for the Tantric Colleges. Now, the Tantric Colleges of the Tibetan system are where the highest the best practitioners, they would take them into the Tantric Colleges and teach them Tantric meditation practices for over a 6-year period. And the Dalai Lama said they were the most disciplined people in the world that entered these colleges. They would have to do meditations that would go for 12 hours a day, and they would get half an hour off in the middle of the day. So they would have to do a meditation for 6 hours, and sometimes these practices would go on for a week. So you could imagine the level of discipline. They weren't allowed to come to any of the practices 30 seconds late. Even if they had been in the college for 3 or 4 years, if they arrived late and they didn't have a particular excuse, then they would be asked to leave. And he was the disciplinary abbot for the Tantric College. And he said to me, he said, we were talking about discipline one time, he said, he said, "Firstly, if you want to discipline someone, say you're a naughty boy, you talk generally about the conduct." Right? You just talk generally about the conduct. And if the person doesn't go, "Uh-oh, that's me," and sort it out, he said, then you talk specifically. And he said, and third time, out. No more talking. And he was really clear about that, because these people had this extraordinary opportunity of doing these very ancient, incredible practices. And if they weren't going to play the game, then they had to make way for someone that was going to be another student. So I guess I've digressed a little bit, but what I'm talking about is this attitude of mindfulness about things, about mindfulness about your actions. If I do this, what is the result going to be? What is my attitude to this? How am I going to create the best positive result out of this? Difficult when there's grey areas? Very difficult. My niece just recently had a cat that was injured. And it was really interesting that she and her family, she's a student, she's married, but she's gone back to university, and her husband's not earning very much money, so they don't have very much money at all. And the cat was injured, and all of a sudden they take the cat to the vet, and he said, oh, it's going to be $1,000. He said, oh, we can put the cat down. There's the situation. What do you do? She said, no, we'll pay the money. And my mother heard about it, and she's now helped her granddaughter out, which is fabulous. But there is a decision. It happened to me when I, many years ago, found a pigeon on my doorstep. Do you know the pigeon story? You do. No one else does, do they? Oh, you do? Yeah. Okay, four of you. So, pigeon on my doorstep. And this pigeon, by the way, had walked up 1, 2, 3, 4 flights of stairs to get to my front door. And it was sitting there, and when I went in the evening, I thought, oh, look, it's probably just cold or something. So I put some seed out and some water, and next morning I came out and it didn't look well at all. And then I realised it had a bent wing. So I rang up a vet and they said, oh, pigeon, oh, we put those down. I went, I don't want that to happen. So he said, oh, look, over in Kensington there's a bird doctor, bird vet, take it there. So I put the pigeon in the box, go over to the vet, and he opens the lid and he said, oh, and he checks the pigeon out and he said, look, this pigeon's wing is badly, badly damaged, and it's going to have to come up, otherwise it will die. He said, as a vet, because they're not a native bird, we actually euthanize them. We put them down. And I said, I have a real problem with that. I said, I'm a Buddhist. And I said, I can't, I don't want that to happen. He went, ah! He said, my mother-in-law's a Buddhist. He said, I've worked in Hong Kong. He said, that's okay. He said, and then he very carefully worded it. He said, if this pigeon was your pigeon, he said, then we could save it. If it was your pigeon. I went, you know, it sunk in. I went, yes, it's my pigeon. He said, ah, good, we can save it. He said, it's going to cost you $1,000. It must be the standard fee. And I went, oh, no. Okay. He said, however, he said, because you're doing this act of compassion, he said, I'm going to halve the bill. Cost you $500. I went, yeah, great, go right ahead. The nurse came out and she said, oh, thank you. She said, no one ever saves pigeons and I really like them. So anyway, I go home and I look on the internet at pigeon.com. There is pigeon.com. and I find out that pigeons live for 35 years. Because what he'd said when I was leaving, he said, well, it'll never fly again. You'll have to keep it in a cage and look after it for the rest of its life. I go home and I find out I've got a pigeon for the next 35 years. Oh, well, that's what happens. That's what happens. I'm saving the pigeon. And he rings me up. It was great. He rings me up. The operation's a success. It's going to be all right. And come and pick up the pigeon next day. So I get the pigeon and then I have to wrap it in a towel and squeeze antibiotics down its throat. And I don't know if you know anything about pigeons, but pigeons can fill up their cage in droppings in one day. Which means I have to clean out for the next 35 years pigeon droppings twice a day for the next 35 years of my life. And I'm going, oh, well, that's just what happens. And then about a month later, I was telling a friend this, and she went, I think I have a solution for you. She said, I've got a friend up the North Coast that has another one-winged pigeon in a huge aviary. She said, I'll ring her. And I get a phone call. She said, oh, she really wants your pigeon so they can be friends. So Daisy, I called my pigeon Daisy. I thought that was a good name. So all of a sudden, Daisy the pigeon went up to join the friend and they waddled around together. And so, thankfully, I didn't have to look after a pigeon and clean out a cage twice. But I just saw all this interaction for me of trying to do the right thing. Not me being special, but this was the pigeon's karma. The fact that the pigeon got to my front door, the fact that the vet was available that didn't want to put the pigeon down, that gave me the right line to say to keep the pigeon alive. And then all of a sudden, I just had to accept that this was going to be my lot for the rest of its life, for 35 years. And I was going to have a pet pigeon. And it didn't like me, by the way. Every time I went near the pigeon, it'd go, I've never heard of a pigeon hissed, it'd go, I'm thinking, oh, great, here am I saving the pigeon's life. It really didn't like me. It didn't think I was friends at all. But in the end, the right action created harmony all the way through, and the lady on the North Coast was happy, and the other pigeon was happy, and she also had a one-winged seagull as well called Eric. Anyway. And this is, I guess, what I've seen in my life over time, is that when you do the right action, the energy of supporting that is pretty good. Now, it doesn't always work out that way. I'm not saying this is a blanket thing. But really, if you start to look at when you've done the right action with the right intention, how that works out. So it's not just about us. It's about the broader world. And this is how we, in a sense, become good people within Buddhism. And yes, okay, we also make mistakes and we fall down. And there's a wonderful line I heard many, many years ago. If every bodhisattva gave up every time they made a mistake, there'd be no Buddhas. So it's not about, oh, I'm a terrible person, I didn't get that right. It's about moving on. It's not about mourning the past. If you recognise you've done a wrong action, recognise it. Don't repeat it. And do some action that, in a sense, repairs that. And for me, saving the pigeon was for anything that I'd accidentally killed or trodden on in my life or been unmindful about, washed down the sink, an ant or something. Saving that pigeon became an act for me, in a sense, or representative of saving all beings. So it was a really important pigeon for me, and I realised that if I had to look after it for 35 years, that was the deal I had to do. And this is what I learned about Buddhism, because otherwise I may not have done that. If I had just been an ordinary, oh, well, you take it to the vet, it puts it down, I don't have to worry about it. And this is the responsibility that you have of knowledge and wisdom. When you understand this stuff, you also have a responsibility of carrying it out to the best of your ability. Even if it looks like the consequences are going to be quite difficult, you still have to do it. And so you have to develop this quality about yourself of creating harmony around you, of the best kind of attitude you have. And yes, we have bad days, but not dwelling on that and working out how to create the best positive result from your actions. The Buddha said, the way is not the sky, the way is in the heart. It's about how you use this attitude of mind, this compassion and love for sentient beings, and that creates the bigger picture. Right. Yeah?
What about the cockroaches?
What about them?
Cockroach.
Very difficult. In Sydney, it really, really is difficult. And these are the grey areas. as much as possible, try to keep the place clean, try to do everything that you can possibly do. But I know in Sydney it's really difficult. And there was a... It's almost impossible. I think you have to make your own decision then. And I think in the end that if it's going to ruin your health, you have to make another decision. And this was I'll give you an example. Right? I'm not going to say directly because it is difficult, but there was a situation where a friend of mine had a cat with a tick. And that tick, if it didn't come out, was going to kill the cat. But if you took the tick out, it was going to kill the tick. So he asked this lama, what's the situation? And the lama said, well, what was your motivation? He said it was saving the cat. He said, well, your motivation wasn't to kill the tick. Even though the action was, your motivation was the best that you could do, because if you didn't take it out, the cat was going to die. If health is going to be compromised badly, then you may have to make a decision. Or you may have to move house. There's another decision. There's always a way of looking at it, but that's a difficult one. And I agree, in Sydney it's really bad. With this cold weather we're having now, you probably notice there's not many cockroaches around. We have a problem at our Buddhist centre. We have cockroaches, and what we do is just clean and clean and clean and put things down that they don't like. By the way, cockroaches don't like bay leaves, and they don't like lavender. All right? So we had a problem with our microwave, which ended up getting so many cockroaches in, we actually chucked it out and put it on the tip. We got another one, we put bay leaves underneath, and it reduced it. And we just made sure that we would clean the cupboards out regularly. And also, the thing that attracts cockroaches is their own droppings. And it smells. So if you clean it out and get rid of that, then they're not attracted to that. And we actually have a situation where we have a few, but we don't have a lot. So there's a way of doing it. Okay? So, another quote from the Buddha. In the end, these things matter most. How well did you love? How fully did you live? And how deeply did you let go? Now, what's that last line mean? How deeply did you let go? What do you reckon that means? Exactly. Letting go your attachment. Letting it go. When you are grasping onto something, you create your own problems. Things are impermanent. You don't have to own up to this one. I'm just going to throw this question out. Have you ever had anyone that's been obsessed with you? Yes. Or have you any... On the other side, have you ever been obsessed about somebody? Okay. And I'm not even looking, because you'll give it away. However, if you have ever been obsessed with someone, your sheer presence over a period of time absolutely irritates them, and they don't want to know about you. That grasping creates its own problem. Or conversely, if someone is following you around and ringing you 7 or 8 times a day, in the end, you want nothing to do with that person. It's plainly obvious that grasping doesn't work. So the idea of possessing or owning something is actually a fallacy. My cup. This is my cup. No one's taking this cup from me. My cup. I don't recognise that someone dug the clay out of the ground. Someone made the cup. Someone bought the cup and sold it on. And in fact, it was just put here tonight, but it's now my cup. Do you see how we do stuff like that? And the cup's impermanent for a start. If that cup is taken away, will I be unhappy? How much importance is that to me? I remember quite a few years ago during the Bosnian War, and it was really quite it was really kind of sad. There was this guy It was on television, and they were interviewing this guy, and he was standing on a pile of bricks and weeds, and he had a machine gun. And the interviewer went up to him and said, "Well, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, this is my..." He said, "I was a doctor." Was. He didn't say I am. He said, "I was a doctor. And this is my ancestral home. And I will kill anyone that comes on this..." This. Now, what he was standing on was a pile of rubble and weeds. What he was supposing was that this was sacred ground. And he was going to shoot someone that tried to take away a brick or a weed. I mean, completely ridiculous. Obviously the man was distressed, and obviously he had seen a lot of suffering. But he was grasping onto something that was a figment of his mind. There was no house there. There was nothing beautiful to look at. There was his ancestral home, which he had in his mind. And it was really interesting. There's a quote from a guy called Woody Allen, who's done movies, and he said, how did he put it? He said, "Tradition is the illusion of permanency." So here he had this tradition. He said, "Oh, my ancestors have been here for 300 years, and I'm going to kill anyone that comes near it." Ridiculous. And so if you look at the way we... And we can examine ourselves. Hopefully it's never on that level, but we examine ourselves and look at what we're trying to hang on to and what we're trying to push away, and this constant struggle of wanting and not wanting keeps our minds agitated, and that state of agitation is extremely unpleasant. I had got a new car about 12, 18 months ago, and on the back of it someone has taken a key and done a big scratch. And I've left it there as a sign of what happens to beautiful new cars. And someone goes, "Oh, look what's happened to your car." I went, "Yeah, that's what happens to cars." And, you know, it's about that long. It's really ugly. And all the duco is really nice and clean. And there's this big scratch. Someone's decided they've just put a key along there. And for me, yeah, it's a good symbol of attachment. So in a funny kind of way, this person's given me a good lesson, because a new car, you never want to have your new car scratched. You know, when it's 20 years old, it kind of doesn't matter. So at which point, this is a lesson in emptiness and dependent arising, at which point is your car old and which is it new? On which day does it turn between your precious new car to it's my old car? You know, if you look at the way we look at things, you start to get a bit amused at what we're doing with stuff. And we become so precious about things that 2 years later we go, "Oh, what's the point?" Someone said to me, talking about shoes, they said, "Oh, you have all the shoes you need plus one more pair." They said it about guitars too. They said, "Oh, you have all the guitars you need plus one more." How many can you play? How many pairs of shoes can you wear? "Oh, that'll make me happy. That'll make me happy." It doesn't mean that we have to walk around in rags and poverty, but it's about how deeply did we let go. And just relax about some of the things that we think are so important. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't get good jobs and look after our families and have a comfortable life. It's not about that. You know, the other side of it is, "Oh, well, okay, well, if material wealth and everything is unhappiness, I'll become completely poor and that'll be happiness." No, it's not about that. It's about the grasping attitude. It's not the owning of it. One of the students in Melbourne went to... And he very wealthy IT guy who was living at the Buddhist Centre, and he went to my teacher and said, "Oh, I'm going to buy a Porsche. Is that okay?" And my teacher said, "Ah, very good car. Best quality. Fantastic." And then he looked at him and said, "Will you check to see in the night if it's okay? Will you check to see if it has any scratches? Will you check..." Will you worry about it all the time? He said, then your pleasure becomes your torture. Depends on your mind, not the car. Those are the lessons we need to know. Depends on your mind, not the car. And so he bought the car, and he's still got it, and he's happy driving it, and he's really not paranoid about this car, because he had to look at himself and said, well, if I get it, that'll be a problem. And a client of mine once, she was not very wealthy, and she'd become engaged, and as an engagement present, her future husband bought her something she'd always wanted, a red Mercedes Sports. This was absolutely the best thing that she could get from this new husband, a red Mercedes Sports. And she told me she was getting it, and then I went round and saw them, his clients, and I said, you get your cash? Oh, it's just wonderful. I've so wanted this car. And then about a few weeks later, she said, I've got to drive to Balmain. Is there off-street parking at Balmain? I said, not that I know of, really. Is there a car park? Well, no, not really. She said, well, then I'll take a cab. I said, well, why don't you drive? She said, well, I'm terrified that my car will get scratched. I went, oh, okay. And then about 4 months later, I didn't inquire. I said, oh, well, 6 months. I said, how's this car going? She said, I got rid of it. I said, why? She said, it was driving me nuts. She said, I was scared someone was going to rip the top. You know, it was a soft top. Put a knife through it. I'm scared. I'm driving a much safer car now. And what she meant was not safety in terms of mechanics, but something that wasn't causing her grief. A friend of mine who was a musician in the 1970s bought a $2,500 guitar. Now, in the 70s, that's a lot of money. We're talking 12, 15 grand's worth of guitar. And he always wanted this guitar. It was immaculate. Everyone looked at it. Oh, it's beautiful, you know. So he said to me, 3 months later, he said, I sold it to my mate Timmy at a discount. I said, why? He said, it was torture. He said, I was worried about it all the time. I would come home and I'd keep it under the bed. I never took it out. I couldn't take it to a party and play it for anyone. He said, it was just murderous. He said, I sold it to Timmy. He doesn't care. He takes it to parties, leaves it out, doesn't care. Same guitar, different attitude. One was torture, one was a pleasure. And so this is the point that I'm making. It's about our attitudes, and it's our attitudes that make us good people or bad people. It's about whether we're going to create a positive view of life for ourselves and others. And this is really this ultimate view. So we have this attitude, and I was going to talk about the Eightfold Path. So we talk about right view. What's our right view? Right view is the beginning of the path. And it simply means to see and to understand things as they really are. So it's our duty, in a sense, as Buddhists, to try and work out how things really do exist. And we've got heaps and heaps of teachings. The wonderful thing about the Buddha Dharma is that we had 50 years of Buddha's teachings. Incredible. And then we had unbelievable amount of realized beings examining the teachings, expanding them, doing commentary. So we have thousands and thousands of books of the Buddha Dharma that gives us a way to be, a way to work out the right view. But the first of the right view was the Four Noble Truths, that there is dissatisfaction. Yes, if I look at myself, yes, I get dissatisfied. Yes, sometimes I suffer. Physically, maybe emotionally, whatever. There is a cessation to that. The next one is there is a cause to that. There's a cause for why I suffer. Buddha was so clear. Oh, okay, I have dissatisfaction. There's a cause for it. Thank goodness. Now I know there's a reason. There's a cause to that. And the cause of that suffering is ignorance, and basic ignorance is the first one. attachment and aversion. Those three things. That's the cause of my suffering. If I can eliminate ignorance, aversion and attachment, or lessen it on the path, then I'm going to have an easier life. And then he said, okay, so there's also a cessation to that, and there's a way to tread that path. So that was right view. Then we have right intention. What's my motivation? What's my intention around this? Right speech. How am I talking to this person? Am I talking down to them? Am I abusing them? Am I causing them suffering? Am I really wanting my speech to be a benefit to them? Right action, again, how are you living your life and what you're doing with it? Right livelihood, is what I'm doing causing suffering? Manifesting suffering? Right effort, how much effort am I putting into what I'm doing? Am I spending my whole life online gambling and losing my money constantly? I remember there was in talking of gambling, there was a Las Vegas casino owner, and he was out the front of his casino and they were interviewing him, and he had a big Stetson hat on and he was standing back like this, and he said, you know, this whole town's built on losers. But he said, not us. We're the winners. He said, they haven't worked it out yet. He said, gamblers lose, casino owners win. That's it. Wow. And you hear that, you go, yeah, it's really pretty obvious. And then you find so many people gamble and lose their money. And they go, oh, now I'm broke. And then they lose their money, and then they embezzle from their work, and then they end up in jail, and they go, how did I get here? Basic grasping. I think that if I do this, then I'll make some money. I knew a woman. I knew the daughter of the mother of someone I knew, who lost $30,000 to the Nigerian scam. Now, does everyone know the Nigerian scam?
Yeah.
We've all got the letters.
Yeah.
She gave them $30,000. Because they wrote to her and said, we will give you $5 million if you just say you this and send us a little bit money to set up the bank accounts. And so it started off at 50 and then 100 bucks and then 1,000 bucks. And it went on. And finally her son stepped in and said, Mum, what are you doing? She said, oh, look, just a little bit more. I'm sure they're going to give me the $5 million. You can't believe that people do that. But people do that. I actually did, though, once get... I had won a lottery, $5 million in an English lottery. Well, the letter came. It said I'd won $5 million in the English lottery. And so they said all I had to do was send $50 for processing and they'd send me $5 million. I went, wow, that's terrific. I didn't buy a ticket. And it's only going to cost me $50. So I wrote back to them and I said, I authorise you to take the $50 out of the $5 million. And I did. And send me the balance. And do you know what? They got really upset. And they sent me a letter and said, it is illegal to do this. Send money immediately. I got bored with it then. But you see the stupidity of it.
Yeah.
And it must work because people, they keep doing it, don't they? Amazing. The one that I kind of liked, and this is really interesting, one I got from somewhere, and it said, we realise you are a good Christian person with good morals and honest, and this is why we are writing to you. Because, and then it went on to say what they were doing. They wanted me to lie blatantly that I was the cousin of this person so that they could transfer all this money. I thought, here they are. They're asking me to be a good moral person and then asking me to lie completely to say that I'm a relative so that this money can be transferred to me. And it's just incredible. Incredible attitude. Anyway, we won't go on about that. Right mindfulness, really looking at the mind. What is happening to my mind right now? There is a practice that we can do right from now on. As you walk down the street, say, what is my mind doing right now? What am I thinking right now? What is my intention right now? And you can do some very, very wonderful work right at any moment. What is my mind doing now? And in that instant that you change from worry, fear and guilt, you are bringing your mind into the reality of what is going on. Because there is no reality outside of the present. There is no other reality. There is the past, and there's causes from the past, but those causes are happening in the present. There is no future, because it doesn't arrive. It seems like it does, but that's just the present again. So in a sense, what we're actually having is an ever-present movement that's always present. We never get to there because it's always the present. And we can't find that because that's always the past. And so if we recognise that, that's actually very, very powerful. Recognising that all our power and all our action is in the present. We can look at our motivation, we can look at our mind, we can look at our actions, and we can generate really powerful, powerful future. Because if we generate positivity now, the future will be assured. So when we get to it, it's going to be a positive result. The sad thing about karma, unfortunately, well, I'll say the last one, right concentration. So that's our meditation practice. There's the Eightfold Path. But one of the unfortunate things about karma is that there is a gap between the cause and the result. So we don't necessarily see an action resulting immediately. And the reason for that is that for a cause to finally become a result, we have to have the conditions. Now, in this life, I have made a decision. There is one condition of way that I will not die. I've worked it out. I am not going to die jumping out of a plane with a parachute on. So if there are causes and conditions that are going to wipe me out with a parachute on my back, that's one way it's not going to happen. I may go down in a plane crash, that's a different matter. But I am not going to die. I am not going to die with a parachute on my back jumping out of a plane. And so I have eliminated one cause of my early demise. Oh, I'm bungee jumping, in case the rope breaks. Sorry, the elastic band. But if we look at that, we can start to eliminate. You know, I'm joking, but we start to eliminate. One of the causes of suffering is having a negative, angry mind. If you're walking around with this attitude of being really grumpy about your life and very dissatisfied, then you are creating causes and conditions for negative things to happen. For negative things to happen. In fact, I was talking to my son tonight. He's 35. And he was talking about a friend he's got. In fact, he and his friend were talking about it, and they were talking about someone I've known since he was a little kid, and they said, this guy is always getting beaten up. I went, what do you mean he's always getting beaten up? They said he walks around really aggressive attitude in his life. And my son Daniel said, yeah, he said, if we're in a pub or somewhere, he said, I actually have to go in and calm things down. And say, look, he didn't really mean it, and he said, I've done it so many times. And he's not even saying very much. He's just looking really angry and grumpy. And so he's creating causes for violence to himself. I said, that's just ridiculous. And he said, yeah. And the other friend said, yeah, we've actually said to him, stop doing that. You know, lighten up. And he may be depressed or whatever. There may be other conditions. But just that attitude is creating the causes and conditions for negative karma to ripen on him. And so if we look at ourselves, again, we have to come back to ourselves and say, what am I creating? What kind of a life do I want? What am I creating right now? So it becomes this self-responsibility. And that's the beauty about Buddhism. So in other words, whatever you're experiencing is all your fault. That's the good news. If it's someone else's fault, if it's someone else pulling the strings, we're in deep trouble. But because it's our causes and conditions from the beginningless time and beginningless rebirths, then we actually have a choice. Okay, we sometimes can't stop negative karma coming through. We haven't purified it and things happen. But at that very moment we're experiencing, we have choice. That's the fabulous part. We have choice right at that moment. Are we going to perpetuate the negative experience by being negative about it, or are we going to recognise that that's ripening karma and that we have to let go about it? If you want a negative person to go away who's giving you a hard time, be nice to them. Be nice to them. A friend of mine many years ago was running a Buddhist centre in Darlinghurst called the Ocean of Peace. And he had every single kind of person coming to that centre that you could imagine. There were transvestites, there were transsexuals, there were ex-drug addicts. He had one rule. You do not come in here intoxicated. That's it. If you're on anything or you're drunk or whatever, no, you don't come in here. Otherwise, you're all welcome. And a situation happened one evening where he heard this commotion downstairs. And he went downstairs and there was this big bikey with his hand around the throat of a very, very young transsexual, and he was about to beat the hell out of this poor person. And my friend, who's not a big guy, he's quite slim, he just stood in front of this person, pushed her back, stood in front of it and said, no, please don't hit. So he really put himself in the line of fire. This is an incredible act of compassion and bravery. And he said, I said, what happened? He said, this guy just went bang and hit me with a full force. He said, I literally flew up in the air and hit the ground. I said, what did you do then? He said, I got up and just whispered a prayer in front of the guy. I said, what happened? He said, he screamed and ran off. I said, is that what you did? He said, yeah. Well, he said, I couldn't fight. I can't fight. He said, I just did that and just said a prayer to him. And he said, this bike, he just took off up the road. Now, that's incredible. Right at that moment, he had an opportunity of sending this guy compassion, even though he'd punched him really hard. He said, oh, it really hurt. You know, there was no magical experience here. He said, oh, I had an aching jaw for weeks afterwards. Luckily he didn't break it. But he was able to, in that moment, do an absolute incredible act of compassion and wish peace and happiness on this guy that had beaten him up. Amazing. Now, this guy's been a practitioner for well over 30 years at that stage, a Westerner. But every morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, he gets up and does 2 hours practice. And he has done every single morning for his whole life. Incredible. And if you met him, you'd never know he was a Buddhist, never talks about it, but does amazing acts of compassion all the time. So this is really, you know, about being a good person. Examine your behaviour, examine your mind, and work with it. Whatever understanding you have, it says in the teachings, whatever understanding you have, work with that. However many you speak, what good will they do if you do not act upon them? So it's great being a scholar, and wisdom is important, but it's more about what you do, and it's about, for all of us really, because, you know, we're not monks and nuns, having the wonderful opportunity of really doing some deep practice. It's about how you interact. Who you bump into, who you help, the opportunities and using that compassion and wisdom all the time. I think that's all the quotes. Oh, okay, here's one more. This is from the Dalai Lama from the Art of Happiness. Whether our action is wholesome or unwholesome depends on whether that action or deed arises from a disciplined or undisciplined mind. So that's important, okay? This is this practice of mindfulness. That's a disciplined mind. Going, ah, oh, it doesn't matter. Doesn't whatever. From a disciplined or undisciplined state of mind. It is felt that a disciplined mind leads to happiness and an undisciplined mind leads to suffering. And in fact, it is said that bringing about discipline within one's mind is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. So what we mean discipline here is not this rigidity, but just paying attention. Because most of the time we don't. It's a natural thing to be distracted. We practice meditation and then get up and immediately the mind goes off. So if anything, if your practice just becomes a practice of being present and knowing the teachings that all of you had, many of you have had years of teachings and understandings, and some of you have had the incredible good fortune of growing up as Buddhists and understanding these teachings, you then have this wonderful opportunity of putting them into practice moment by moment. Not tomorrow, but now. Oh, yeah, well, I'll become holy in a couple of weeks. Just do it now. Just now. And if you do that, you actually become a good person and you'll actually generate happiness, and you'll generate happiness for yourself, and you'll generate happiness for everybody else. And life won't be so hard. One of the big problems that I've come across, and this is of various faiths, unfortunately, we as Buddhists have this wonderful opportunity of understanding karma. There's a woman I know, a Jewish woman, whose daughter died of a brain tumour. She was a client of mine, and I couldn't say anything, but she said, "Why did this happen?" She said, "Why would this happen? My daughter was a good person. I've been a good... Why would this happen?" And that tortured her. You know, sure, a daughter died and it was tragic circumstances, but the not knowing. And I couldn't say to her, well, look, this is karma. Because immediately you say that to someone who doesn't have the understanding of Buddhism, they say, what, you mean I was a bad person? I was never, you know, you can't go there. You really can't go there. Because unless they have the understanding of previous lives and that a karma can come from a previous life and happen here, then you're having to explain a whole system. And this is the responsibility we have as Buddhists. Yes, we can talk Buddhism to other Buddhists, but we can't ram it down the throat of people that don't understand. It's really unfair and extremely cruel. So, you know, things happen in life that are disasters, and we can say, okay, well, that's come from a previous time. It's not about blame. It's just an actual understanding of karma. And so we have to take that on ourselves, not to say too much. We can't stand on the corner and say, I think you should become a Buddhist, it'll be good for you. Even the Dalai Lama said when he was here, he said, I never ask people to change their religion. But the wonderful thing, he says, is if Buddhism has something to offer, then take it. Buddhism's free to be given. And I had a Catholic priest once ring me up and he said, listen, he said, can I come to your centre? I said, yeah, sure. He said, I'm a Catholic priest. And he said, I reckon you guys have got a better handle on meditation than we have. And he said, do you mind if I come and listen to how you guys meditate? I said, yeah, please. And he came for three or four sessions and then he went, thanks, that's what I needed. Left. Fabulous. That was wonderful. I felt really happy that, you know, he didn't say, oh, I want to convert or whatever. Or, you know, no, he was going to take that technology and use it. Okay, that's all. Any questions? Yep.
This seems like a bad question to ask, considering you said it was really hard to explain to somebody. But so does that mean that anything that bad happens can be traced back to something bad that you did in a previous life? That's where the negative...
Yeah. It's a negative... You've created a negative cause.
Okay.
So anything that happens in your life can be a negative cause. However, there are four conditions for a karma to a fully, what they call a fully karma, fully fully karmic action to ripen is you have to have the intention, you have to have the action, you have to have the completion, and you have to have the satisfaction. Otherwise, if some of those aren't present, maybe you accidentally, ran over something in your car. You didn't have the intention to do it. You did do the action. You don't rejoice in it, you know. And so, therefore, that karma may come about, but it's not. It's not sure when and how that's going to function.
So does that mean that the girl with the brain tumor in some past life had?
Yep, had created some causes and conditions for that to ripen.
Okay.
Yep. And it's not a blame. It's not like, oh, you were a bad person. Hey, listen, if we look at beginningless lives, we were all bad people and we were all good people and we've done fabulous things and we've done really rotten things. That's the nature of life. That's the nature of previous lives. And from a Buddhist perspective, we have had beginningless lives. There has not been a time when we created our first life. So we have beginningless karmas. So the point being is if we know that causes and conditions create the result of negative karma, then create in this life causes and conditions that can only begin to have positive repercussions. So having a peaceful, compassionate, loving mind is fertile ground for positive karma to come through. Having an angry, grasping, negative, cheating mind will bring disaster. You look at people in the mafia. They get caught, they get shot, they get killed. We're looking at the killings around Sydney. You live a negative life. And yes, that negative life may not be having repercussions from this life, but it's creating the karma causes and condition, or the conditions for previous negativity to ripen. So that's all you have to know. You have to know that, yes, in the past you have done good things and bad things. Create the conditions in this life for those things to ripen in the most positive way. And all the things that we do in a positive way will help that. Yep.
The Buddhist concept of a good person, in your opinion, does it share a lot of ground with the Anglo-Christian society's concept of a good person?
So what's the question?
The Buddhist concept of a good person, in your opinion, does it share a lot of common ground with the Anglo-Christian society?
Oh, yeah. If you look at all the great religions of the world, and even the minor ones that aren't even great, the idea of positive action, compassion, love and wisdom is the same for all of them. And someone said to me once, they said, oh, do you think God put all these different religions in the world so that you can recognise God and be a good person? I went, no, the sheer nature of our absolute Buddha nature finds the truth. And the truth is evident in all the great religions that follow compassion, love, wisdom. And you look at it in Christianity. In fact, Christianity is very close to Buddhism. It has that principle of turning the other cheek and creating love and harmony. Why? Because as human beings, we have discovered the right way to be. You know, if you want to know if someone, a friend, walk up to someone and yell at them and see how long they're going to be your friend. Oh, okay, well, I've worked that out. If I'm horrible to somebody, I'm not in community with them. It's bleedingly obvious. And so you're absolutely correct. All the great religions have discovered the same truth. When human beings really spend time looking at themselves and looking at what they're creating, they come up with the same answers. We were very lucky in having the Buddha that looked at the most deep level, incredible level, to understand that. But then all great teachers have found that. You look at the teachings of Jesus Christ, same deal, you know. Unfortunately, though, poor Jesus only had 3 years of teaching. We have the legacy of our great teacher having 50 years.
Do you think Aristotle, Socrates and Plato's teaching wisdom is much lower and much shallower than Buddha's?
Oh, look, I can't say that. Because I look at some of their wisdom and I think it's fine. No, I'm not about sort of splitting hairs and saying, oh no, they didn't quite have it or that. This becomes a personal thing, and frankly, I would actually have to sit down with them and truly talk to their philosophy. I mean, it's been coming down through the ages. I don't have that knowledge. But yes, if you look at good, you look at people that say they're atheists. I know one guy who was a complete atheist, an incredible guy, gave money away and was helpful to everyone and fabulous. Oh, well, he's an atheist, therefore he's not a Buddhist, so therefore he's not that good. No, rubbish, he's an incredible guy. Did many more wonderful things than I've ever done in my life, and he was a complete atheist. So that's what we rejoice in. We rejoice in the attitude and the actions. We don't split hairs and go, oh, well, they're, you know, that's that camp, so they're not as good, or no, that doesn't work for us. We have to, in fact, rejoice. And, in fact, my teacher said exactly that same thing. He said, and this was when I was sort of a new Buddhist, so I kind of was a bit surprised. He said, oh, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism. He said, just words. Just words. He said, only one religion, good heart. That's it. And I went, okay, got that. So
said the same. Someone asked him, so how would you describe your religion? Because of that whole debate versus way of life or religion.
Yeah.
He said, my religion is simple, it's kindness.
There you go.
It is
exactly. So cultivating the good heart is our practice. Whether you call it Buddhism, in 50,000 years, we probably won't have a name called Buddhism. It might be called the good heart practice, you know. That's fine. Doesn't matter what the word is. It's not about creating we're special, they're not. We just, as I said, we had the luxury of our teacher having 50 years on the planet. And it said that he developed a teaching for the 84,000 delusions that we have. Well, that's incredibly lucky. And, you know, when the next Buddha comes, hopefully that will continue, and then the next Buddha after that, and, yeah.
You were talking earlier about the, I think, 264 sort of...
65, yeah, vows of a monk. Yeah.
What is, like, what if you don't agree, what if your moral judgment isn't in line with one of those views? Then what do you do?
Well, I'll give you one. I know for a fact that nuns and monks can't, how can I put it? They can't. A nun can't do more than shake your hand. And I know one fabulous Tibetan Buddhist nun that gives me a hug. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason for not having physical contact in case there is sexual misconduct, but she doesn't have a problem with it, and I certainly don't have a problem with it, and she goes, g'day, boom. And I've seen the Dalai Lama do the same thing to women and men, give them a big hug. So that would be one vow. Which, you know, what's your motivation? So, yes, I would imagine there are the ones like... I don't know them all, so I can't say, but there would be many like that. But the ones that are immutable, you know, not immutable, but killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, they're, you know, they're pretty much written in stone. But the rest, it's about mindfulness. So when that nun gives me a hug when I see her... It's Robina Corton, by the way, fabulous nun. Do you know Robina Court? Ah, amazing lady.
I knew it was her when you said that.
And, you know, she's absolutely cool and it's fine by me, and I'm sure her teachers go, yeah, whatever, that's fine. It's not about being closed-minded. And I've got another friend who's a nun who's just become a nun, and she shakes my hand like that. She used to give me a hug. And I'm hoping one day... You know, I would never push it, but one day maybe she'll get a little bit looser and go, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, point taken, you know. You would have to... And it's important to run everything that you listen to through your own attitudes and consciousness. You don't accept... One of the wonderful things that I... My first lecture of Buddhism in 1978 from my teacher was, don't believe me, you check up. And I went, oh, fabulous. I don't have to... get caught up in dogma, I can actually run this through my own attitudes and understandings and come up with the right answer for myself. And, you know, people will come to our centre and say, I don't believe in reincarnation, can I come? Yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, what do you want to listen to? Well, I don't know about this reincarnation. I said, yeah, okay. Someone said to me, do you believe in reincarnation? I said, yeah, I really do. I really, really do believe in it. And they said, I don't. I went, okay. So what? In the end, it actually doesn't matter. Whether I lived that life or this life. It's actually more about being present now, you know. Or people go back and they all find out they were Cleopatra. So what? You know? Does it matter? It doesn't matter. But knowing there's a continuum, for me, is important as a Buddhist, because I recognise that things happen in this life I probably have created in the past, so I better keep purifying stuff. You know. Anyway, time's up. Thank you very much once again for inviting me. I always appreciate coming, and see you again soon.
Do we have any more questions, sir?